Thanks, Kevin. First, ensure all cell phones are silenced. Then I'd ask that you please help me welcome Patrick from Lompoc, our speaker tonight.
Patrick Guthrie, alcoholic.
I want to thank Lee for asking me to speak, and this is pretty weird for me. I was a Catholic. I was raised Catholic, so I feel like I should maybe say Mass tonight instead of pitch, you know. I don't know. I'll do it in Latin. No, pig Latin. That's it. It's good to be here. And, you know, a lot of you have heard me share before, but I'm going to change it up. Or I'll try to change it up a little bit tonight. And I got sober May the 18th of 1986. So on Wednesday, I'm going to have 30 years. If I can white knuckle it just another 4 days, I'll make it there, you know? And it always makes me feel weird when we celebrate a birthday or when people clap for a birthday. It's like, all right, you're so great. You're not screwing up anymore. And but really, it's like I can't take any credit for it. I mean, I have done everything in this program that you could possibly do wrong except not drink. And the other thing I want to say, just for the newcomer, because I'm mainly going to share about the last 30 years and not so much about the drinking part, and is that it sounds like a sales pitch. It does when we're up here and we're like, try AA. We'll refund your misery if you're not happy. And this is what you can get, a beautiful family, a wonderful life, you know, and all this. And then, or you can go back to drinking and be miserable. And it does sound like a sales pitch. And we go into a place called the Champion Center. I've been doing a panel in there over at in Lompoc. And I always feel like, man, we are we're like salespeople in there. But, you know, I guess it comes off like that. Who's working the mic? Can you add a little bass and some reverb? I want to sound like the great and powerful Oz. And so... you know, I actually got sober in Springfield, Missouri. My first meeting was at the St. James Church, and it was called, they had the name of the meeting was The Lie is Dead. And I thought that was a strange thing, you know, and I went in and this was back when meetings were good, when you could smoke in them, and it was smoky, and it smelled of coffee, and everybody was laughing and having a good time, and people were sharing the most horrific things, and then everybody laughed about it. You were raped, oh, that's so funny, and then you ran into a tree and killed your mom, oh, that's awesome, you know, and it's just like, and I loved you guys right away. I did. I wanted to be a part of it. And I remember, it's like, okay, I'm in. What do I have to do? And they said, all you have to do is have a desire to stop drinking. I'm like, oh, there's got to be more to it than that. No, that's it. No pledges to sign, no promises to make. There's no baptism. There's no... we do pass the plate around, though. It's kind of like church in a way. In fact, especially tonight, I think they're actually using the things are gonna, yeah, there it is, little boxes out, you know, and but we don't sing, although I may sing tonight, you never know. I might just break out in song and dance. And you know, it wasn't that I had tried to stop drinking. I had tried on numerous occasions. I mean, really good solid attempts at it. And they prayed over me. I went to a psychiatrist who the second trip that I went in there wouldn't even open the door. He's like, oh, I think you're okay. Call me and we'll make another appointment. I go, this is my appointment time. He didn't even want to see me. It was probably because the first time I went in there, I had dropped a tab of acid, and I think I freaked him out a little bit. And and I had really, I tried white knuckling it, not doing it. It just nothing worked for me. And so I got sober when I was 23. I mean, it's pretty young. You know, there's a young people's meeting in Santa Barbara that I attend on a monthly basis. It's on Tuesday night, and I say, I got sober at 23. Well, dude, it's not too late, man. You're all right. You know, because there's people in there that are 16 and 17 years old getting sober now. And I think, really, you know, that's kind of young. But then I hear their stories, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I get it. You know, I don't think I could have gotten it at 16. Although, that there was a DUI. I actually totaled 7 cars before I was 21, and you know, there's a lot of that kind of unmanageability in my life. The other thing, you know, I was raised as a Catholic. I love the Catholic Church. I do. It was awesome. I love all the bells and the smells and the rituals and all of that stuff. And what was going on was my dad was molesting my sister and I. And I know I've talked about this before. And, you know, I got to tell you, I did not realize how big of an impact it had on my life. Even now, it's just starting to really sink in what an impact. Because what I did was I blamed him for everything. It didn't make me alcoholic. I will tell you that. I drank, and I never knew what was going to happen. But I will tell you this, that drinking really subsided the hate that I had. And I use the word hate. I mean, it was fury. I was furious. I was furious at him and anybody else that had any authority over me. And so, you know, it went on like this. And there, I joined a punk rock band. I did everything I could to embarrass him, really. And that, sometimes there were blatant embarrassments to him, and other times it was just, I didn't care. And I used to say that a lot, that I just didn't care. And Joe C. at the Freedom Group, which is my home group in Lompoc, and I go to the 7 a.m. meeting. You guys are welcome there anytime. It's a great group. He said, "Patrick, I think you're lying." I'm like, "Probably, you know, I mean, I'm good at it, you know." And it's like, I don't think that you didn't care. I think that you cared too much. And really, man, when he told me that, and it was years ago, it really hit me. I started thinking about it. And that's the other thing. I drank because I just wanted to turn it off, because I did care a lot. I cared about my family, and yet I hated them. I cared about the homeless people, but I just felt powerless to do anything to help them. And I just turned it all inward, you know. So I got sober in Springfield, Missouri. That's where I went to my first meeting, and that was actually in February of 1986. And what had happened prior to that was I was involved in a big drug sting. And I say big drug sting. It was, you know, what they busted me with was about 8 pounds of weed and, I don't know, 4 or 5 ounces of coke. And what the guy told me to bring everything I had. And I'm like, "Everything?" He's like, "Yeah, bring it all. I got a guy who'll buy it all." I'm like, "All right." And I did. And I drove up to St. Louis, and It was in a motel room. Also, at this time, I was drinking, and I drank a lot, but I did other things too. At the time, I was shooting these number 4 dilaudids. I was, it's basically synthetic heroin. And I tell you, if you'd have told me, "Dude, don't shoot the heroin because you won't be able to share as a pure alcoholic," I would have shot it anyway. But the thing is that. I got in that motel room, and I'm jonesing, and we're waiting and waiting forever for the guy with the money, and he finally shows up, and I grab the money from him, and it's like, you know, it was a lot, and I fan through it, and all right, I gotta go, you know. He's like, "Don't you want to count it?" And I'm like, "That's good enough," because I was so out of my mind, and I never made it to the door. all the doors broke down and guns were out and badges were flashed and everybody was screaming and I'm screaming and I was God. And the truth of it is that I ended up testifying for the DEA. And I'll tell you, it's something that there are many things that I am ashamed of in my life, many. And I just keep piling them on. I do. They just keep piling on. And this is one of those good ones, though. You know, like I was a rat, and some people went to jail, and they told me to move and call me when I landed, or call them when I landed. And I drove from Missouri to California, and I started going to meetings in Long Beach, and the night I got to Long Beach, I drank again. I thought that I had it all behind me. I did. And I was at dinner with a girl that I knew from Springfield, and it was innocent. We were at Parker's Lighthouse, if anybody's from Long Beach knows this place. And the waitress came up, and she's like, "Can I get you something to drink?" And I said, she goes, "Coronas are on special." I'm like, "Yeah, I'll take a Corona." "So would you like a lime in that?" I'm like, "Sure." And the girl I was with said, "I thought you weren't drinking anymore." I'm thinking, God, why did I tell her anything, man? And I go, "No, it's all right. It's all right." She goes, "But you made kind of a big deal about it." You know, I go, "Yeah, it's cool. It's you know, it's cool." And she's like, "Are you sure?" And I was just like, "Get me that beer now." And I drank that one beer, and a big argument erupted. And I didn't even get the second beer. She left. They booted me out of the place. And I had to walk. My car was actually in Seal Beach, and I had to walk from Long Beach to Seal Beach. And miracles happen all the time. And that was one of them. And I'll even tell you that it was a miracle that the DEA arrested me. In St. Louis. It was an absolute miracle. I mean, at the time, I thought it was the worst thing that could happen. But in retrospect now, 31 years ago, I see it. It saved my life. That's what really enabled me. The window had opened for me to get sober. It was, and I almost slammed it shut in Long Beach. But for the grace of God, as I'm walking that 9 or 10 miles back to... thanks, Lee. He's got this meeting pretty much under control, except, dude, you read past what you were supposed to read on chapter 5, but it was still right on, man. It's all right, Mike. We're going to let you slide. But he's got it, man. If you need to know what's going on, just ask Lee, all right? And I felt so guilty and ashamed as I was walking back there, because I knew that this thing called sobriety, that this thing I had been given in Springfield was a gift, and I threw it right back in God's face. I did. I threw it right back in his face and just said, "I got this. I got it handled." And I didn't. And in that long walk back, I cried and laughed and cried, and I got back. I got to my car. Once again, I called the hotline, found there was a meeting, and went to a meeting right then. And I've been sober ever since. I got a sponsor. I started working the steps. And I really thought that the steps were... I used to run. I know it's hard to believe, but I did. I ran a 418 mile in high school, and I ran cross country. And when I got into college, they said, "You're not fast enough to run the mile," because there was a lot faster guys where I went to school at. "You're going to run the 5K," but I always saw everything as like a start, the middle, and then the finish line. And this is the finish line, 12 step, the finish line. And so I was just really plowing to get through those steps. And the first time around, even the second time I did them, I wanted. There was some promise, man, that I just not seemed to get, but I knew it was had something to do with the steps. And I raced through them, and I got to that eighth step, and I went out to make amends to my mom and dad. And I had probably 2 or 3 years sober, and they were living in Milwaukee, and I was in the living room, and it was just like I was 17 again, you know? And I looked at my dad, and I thought, man, I don't owe this guy an amends. He owes me the amends. And all that guilt and all that hatred just came up, and just things were said, horrible things. Things that I'm not going to repeat because Lee told me not to cuss from up here. So, but there was a lot of that. And then my dad said, get out and don't ever come back. And I said, that's fine. And I didn't talk to him for the next 10 years. And I'll tell you that I'm hard-headed, and I did not listen to a lot of the good direction that was given to me. And people told me things, and I just thought they were trying to control or get over on me. And I had a real problem with authority. I didn't want anybody to tell me what to do. And so that being said, I worked for the cable company. That was like my first real job in sobriety. And they just weren't paying me enough. I mean, at the time, this was 1986. I was making like $7 or $7.50 an hour, and it just wasn't enough. And so on the side, I hooked up cable, you know, on the side. And that money, of course, went to me because that was the supplemental income that they should have been paying me. This is the way I thought about it. And as I got further into this stealing, you know, because that's what it was. At the time, I just didn't see it like that. I thought, really, TV should be free. And it will be if you pay me $300, you know. And so another thing is I'm really smart. I mean, maybe not book smart, more street smart, but I know how to work the system. And I found these boxes that where you get all the channels. So along with the free cable, you get a box, you're getting everything, all the channels, you know what I mean? All of them. I didn't say anything, all right? And I'm pushing it right up to the edge there. He's going, oh my God, we should have stuck with the girl from Seal Beach, man. No, she couldn't make it, so you can stuck with me. But And what had happened was, once again, I came back from L.A. I'd been doing the cable boxes for a couple years and was making some pretty good money off it. It was a high-profit business, not a lot of competition. And, in fact, I had started mailing these things out to other cities because I learned, like, how to defeat all the different cable systems. And the one was in Louisiana, which was Baton Rouge, which nobody could get. And I had that was a PZ1s, and I'm sure you guys are really impressed. And I had been in L.A. programming these things all night. I had my car full of them. And I pull up to my house. I'm living in Sunset Beach at the time, right on the beach. It was sweet. And I pull up there, and I see a couple guys with suits and ties and the badges on there. On their, you know, on their belt, I'm like, yeah, that they're probably for me, and I got out of the car. I'm trying to be cool. I've been up all night, and mind you, I'm sober. I'm not drinking, all right. And this is what they told me: don't drink no matter what. I thought, okay. What I heard was, you can do anything you want as long as you don't drink. Big difference, let me tell you, huge difference. So I walk up, and these cops are like, are you Patrick Guthrie? And I'm like, no. And like, is this 1865 South Pacific Avenue? I go, oh, no, this is North. And they're like, oh, crap, because you could tell they'd been there a long time. They get in their car, they peel away, and they start to see that the numbers aren't ascending. Like, it's mathematically impossible to get to the other side of Seal Beach and hit the other side of this 186 thing, you know? And they stop, and they light them up, and they pull back, and they jump out, and they are angry. And And they threw me on the ground and cuffed me and threw me in the back. And all my neighbors were like, oh, my God, unhook the box quick. You know,
he's been busted. And
and they threw me in jail. I did 3 months and 15 days in L.A. County Jail. You know, I got out. I had accumulated a little bit of money, and they had I called a friend of mine who said, "Dude, if you get busted, do not call me. You're going to get busted. So don't call me." And my sponsor was saying, "Stop selling those boxes." I couldn't, man. It was like money, you know. I mean, I was so afraid of financial insecurity. I was. And they busted me, and I called my friend who said, "Don't call me." And dude, my Rolex is up on the thing. Go get it, hawk it, and get me out of jail. And they did. And then I went through the whole discovery process. When you're in the court system, it's really an exciting, fun experience. I finally got found guilty, and the judge gave me 2 weeks to get my affairs in order. And I, with all the seriousness, told him, I'm like, "Your Honor, I have been trying my whole life to get my affairs in order." And he didn't think it was funny. And he's like, 1 week, wham! And then I had that week of like, I'm going to jail. Now, it was for 3 months and 15 days, mind you, but you would have thought I was going up to San Quentin for life or something, you know? You know, it's like, oh, I was thinking about running to Mexico. You know, all the stupid stuff that you think about. I finally showed up there, and I bought some new shoes, you know, and I got into L.A. County, and I was put in the 9500 wing of the downtown central jail because somebody had typed their way out of jail like 2 months before that, so they considered what I did a computer crime. And so they like put me in there with really bad people, you know. Like, I didn't belong there. The fact is, I did. And I remember a large Hispanic fellow came up to me and said, "Holmes, those are my shoes." And I looked down, like, "No, man, I just got these. I got them at the Big Five before I came in." He's like, "No, those are mine." I'm like, "Dude, I'm telling you, I am just new in here. I got these things." I mean, I just didn't get it, you know. I wasn't equipped to go in there. And all of a sudden, I fell a whiff of air, and bam, and I was out, and I woke up, and they were his shoes, man, and because I didn't have them on anymore. And that was welcome to L.A. County Jail. I love sharing that story in CMC. I go into a panel up at CMC. It's mostly lifers in there, and I've had this panel for 10 years, and I really like that place. And they always go, "Nice shoes, man." But, you know, it was, you know, and I remember when I celebrated my fifth year of sobriety in L.A. County Jail. "Happy birthday to me. Boom. Happy birthday to me. Those are my shoes. Happy birthday." You know what I mean? It was like, wow. And it was another moment of clarity, another beautiful experience, really. And I'm not being facetious here. This thing saved me. It did, because it was at that moment when I thought, just maybe, it was me. It's my fault. Like, yeah, this is me. It's kind of like when I lived in Long Beach, I got a lot of parking tickets. There's no place to park there. I would go to the court system and get extensions on the parking tickets, to the point where the judge had a stack of them and said, "I'm not giving you any more extensions. You know, you've got to pay this." "I haven't got the money." "Well, by Monday you better, or you're going to go to jail." And I thought, oh my God. And you know how we are. We scrape the money up, and I got it paid off. And this is the thing that got me. If you don't park illegally, you won't get a ticket. No, really, like, wow. You know what I'm saying? If you don't do illegal things, you won't go to jail. I mean, I don't know. That was an epiphany for me. And the other epiphany was, it's all on me. It's not my dad's fault. It isn't. As much as I want to blame him for everything that ever happened to me bad, It's not his fault. There's a thing called inertia, and it's what pushes the train down the track. If it's going 70 miles an hour, it takes a couple miles for that train to stop, especially if it's got a lot of cars behind it. And what I had, and this is what I liken it to, was an inertia of self-destruction. And I tell you, I think a lot of people come in with it. I do. And it is hard to stop all of the self-destructive behavior. We come in and we get sober and it's great and we're so awesome. And then we go to the meetings and it's awesome. And we go home and we're alone. We're like, oh my God, we're alone with our thoughts and ourselves. And you can only pack so much AA into one day. I know people that go to 4 meetings a day, but pretty soon you got to go home and be alone. And the reality is, you've got to work. You got to feed the kids. You got to take care of the wife. You got to. And I don't want to. You know? And so I think there's something else, and it was something I talked about with you earlier about this thing, this forgiveness thing. But underneath that is that there is some part of me deep down that will never be loved. And that is the thing I need to look at. That part of me that will never be loved. And that is the part of me that needs it the most. That thing inside. I don't know if it was my dad took it away or what happened, but there is that thing. And I am really getting in touch with that right now. So I'm going to share about this 8-step or this 9-step that I did 13 years later. I had this Pacific Group sponsor. His name was Clint Hodges. Oh, great man. Just great man. Tom, you know, you look a lot like him, Thomas. You do. He's sleeping. That's cool. But he does. You kind of reminded me of him. He can't hear either. So that's even better. He's like getting that full treatment. But he saved my life. And he was a captain in the Marine Corps. He was a captain in the Marine Corps. Thomas isn't, I know. And he was a Pacific Group member. I mean, that's like a really 1-2 punch if you know those guys. They're tough. They tell you the truth. And this guy did tell me the truth. And I'd been working with him for a year. We were still on the first step. I'm like, come on. And I would come into his office, me and all the other lemmings, you know, that was there. He sponsored a ton of guys. And he would read like one paragraph. He's like, wow, we are just plowing through this material, aren't we? Yeah, and that's what he's always done. We're plowing through this. And there was one morning, he was an attorney, and I made a joke to him, some lawyer joke. This guy did not like lawyer jokes. I don't know, but he especially didn't like lawyer. And he went off on me. He's like, I can't help you anymore. We're done. This book doesn't snap. Anyone snap? We're done. I'm like, no, you're really helping. Come on. It's like, no. He goes, the fact is, I'm going to have to ask you to do something you're not going to be willing to do, so just go and quit wasting my time. I'm like, shh, keep it down. There's a lot of guys out here. I don't want them to hear me, you know, to hear you yelling at me. And they were terrified, too. Like, oh, my God, he's mad. And I go, look, just tell me what it is. He goes, well, tell me, would you be willing to do it? I go, I don't even know what it is. But I thought, willing, that sounds like you don't have to do anything, you know? All right, I'll be willing. He goes, you need to forgive your dad. What? What has he got to do with it? Those old-time AA guys, they know, man. They know. They look right through you. And he looked at me and said, oh, I think you know. I'm not going to be another one of the failed male authority figures in your life. I'm not going to be another one of the people you blame for AA not working. So get out. I thought, all right, I'm willing. It's kind of surprised him. I think it was the takeaway clothes. You know what I mean? How they do that? Like, you don't want this car. Yeah, I do. But And I said, yeah, all right, I'm willing. He's like, okay, well, here's this. Willingness without action is fantasy. What? So here's what you're going to do. In 3 weeks, you're going to we're going to have this forgiveness exercise at this retreat, and I want you to be there. And I thought, okay. And he said, you need to pray to your 9-volt battery God for the willingness to forgive your dad. I was really insulted. I was. I thought I had this great connection with my higher power, but I didn't trust that higher power to do anything for me. Nothing. I mean, I had a connection, but I didn't have the connection. I had 9 volts. That's why I was pulling off that HP. And so for the next 3 weeks, I prayed, and 3 weeks came. I'm at the Mary Joseph Retreat Center in Palos Verdes. Can't get away from the Catholics. And he pulls out this book from Emmett Fox. It's really religious. It is. And in the back it's Sermon on the Mount. And in the back is the Our Father, the prayer, the Our Father prayer. And he's broken it down. He's written a lot of text on this. This guy had a lot of spare time, I guess. And but in it, there's one sentence in the Our Father prayer: "Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us." And from that sentence, there's about 8 pages in there, and within that text is the forgiveness exercise. And he reads it off. It sounds like this: "I fully and freely forgive the whole business." And I say, "My dad." And I thought, I felt something. I don't know how else to explain it, but I did. I felt something. I felt something really like it almost lifted off of my shoulders. I felt like I'd been carrying this weight, this hatred. And I don't want you to think that I'm this great guy for forgiving my dad. I'm not. I am not a great guy. What I am is I was desperate and it was killing me. I had to do it. It's a lot of times this forgiveness, I only do it when my back's up against the wall, when the gun's to my head. It's like, that's how I act. Back against the wall, gun to head. And I've got gun to head right now, and I'm like, I fully and freely forgive. And he says, is there anybody else you want to forgive? I'm like, all right, my mom. Fully and freely forgive. My mom, I'm feeling it. Is there anybody else you want to forgive? Now, in my life, I was a victim, all right? And that's the role I played, victim. And I would set up relationships to be a victim. And then when they victimized me in whatever way they were going to do, if it's a girl or a boss or whatever, I'd say, see, that's what they do. But now I think I understand it even on a deeper level right now. I don't think it's so much victimization as it is self-hatred. It's this, there's some part of an alcoholic that's just in that deep core that's never going to be loved, that has this self-hatred. It's why we drank. It relieves that self-hate. At least I'll say it for me. That's why I drank. It was to relieve that self-hate. And even underneath that guilt and shame, that horrible guilt and shame. And so he's starting to go through he's like, is there anybody else you want to forgive? So I'm letting everybody off the hook. Principal Farwell, the DEA, the teacher, the coach. I mean, they're all getting off the hook. I fully and freely forgive Principal Farwell. And I'm crying like a little girl. And I'm shaking. And the thing is, I'm letting them off the hook. But you know who's getting free? Me. It was a self-made prison. I had made myself, and I was in this prison. And I'm forgiving everybody. See, I always thought if I forgave my dad, that it would be more like a re-victimization for me. I can't let him off the hook. He's got to pay. They all have to pay. They have to pay. And who was paying? I was paying. And so I'm letting them all off the hook. And Clint's sitting there across from me. And he sees that I'm having an experience. And he's like, is there anybody else or anything else you want to forgive? Now, I'll tell you, I've shared this story a lot of times. And I've shared this story at meetings where they have questions and answers afterward. And everybody always asks a question. I thought you were going to say you forgave yourself. I couldn't. I couldn't.
myself off the hook. I just couldn't. But what I came up with was, I forgave God. That was what I came up with. I fully and freely forgave this whole business. And it was at that moment that I was connected to my higher power in a way that I had never been connected. And it's what leads me to this point where I'm at right now, 4 days from 30 years. Will I ever, ever be able to let myself off the hook? It's easy for me not to even think about it. I get busy with work. I've got a beautiful wife and a wonderful daughter. And I love them so much. And it's easy just to get to ignore it all in the cycle of life. I get up, I take my daughter to school every morning. I get to take her to school. It's a privilege. I get to pick her up. She's 13. She's going to hate me soon. I want to get it while she still loves me, you know? And she does love me. She tells me she loves me. I'm like, wow, you know? And my wife tells me she loves me. And so about 4 weeks ago, I'm speaking in Newport Beach. I've spoke at this meeting before. It's a lot bigger and better than this meeting, but you know what I mean? It's a... This night, though, wasn't to be the case. Maybe. I don't know. And actually, I rode up there with Tim. It was his gig, and he said, do the 10 minutes. I said, fine. I get up there. My name's Patrick Guthrie. I'm an alcoholic. Blah, blah, blah. Laugh, laugh, laugh. Clap, clap, clap. Off. Tim gets up there. It's Tim Whitcomb, alcoholic. And then I connected line one to line two. Laugh, laugh, laugh. Ha, ha, ha. And off. He's in the receiving line after the meeting. It's a big meeting, and a lot bigger than this one. So he's in the receiving line, and I'm kind of standing over, and I see this kid looking at me, and he looks like he's pissed off. Angry. He's angry. He's very angry. Also, there's a couple of guys that met us up there. They're ex-cons that I know, you know, like nobody had my back. They're off with their girlfriends. I'm like, dude, get over here, man. You killed somebody before. I know you can do it again. And this kid's coming up on me, and he looks at me. He's like, what's your middle name? And I'm like, oh, I got this one. Hugh. I knew it. I knew it was you. You ruined my life. And he's looking behind me at another guy that's all tatted down and looks like he's got a knife or a gun or something. I figured, all right, this is it. But what a way to go at an AA meeting. Patrick Guthrie shot and killed in Newport Beach, you know. And he wasn't the main speaker, though. So it doesn't count. He was only the 10 minute, but what a 10 minutes he gave. I'll never forget it. I love that guy. And I got this stuff running through my head. And I go, what are you talking about? And what I thought when that guy came up, I figured it had something to do back in Missouri with the whole drug thing, you know, because I got a lot of guilt and shame and remorse over that. I figured, okay, this is somebody's son that's coming up to whack me, you know. And he's like, do you know this girl's name, Alicia, something, something? I go, no. Well, you screwed her and I'm here. I'm like, dude, I have been married for 18 years happily. I have never been unfaithful to my wife. You got the wrong guy. He goes, it wasn't 18 years ago. It was 28 years ago. I'm like, what? He goes, look at me, you idiot. Look at me. I'm like, I'm looking. He's going, I'm your son. I'm like, what? I'm your son, you idiot. And then I looked at him, and he looks just like me. Same big nose and bushy eyebrows, poor kid. Just was like, oh my God. And I'm gonna be waiting outside. I'm like, that's me for sure, you know. I'm not gonna confront somebody, I'm gonna wait outside. And he goes outside, and then the guy with all the tats comes up on me, and I'm like trying to get Tim or one of the USP guys. Come on, man, this guy's gonna do me. And And he's like, oh, I'm the guy's counselor. I drove the bus over here. He's in rehab. I'm like, oh, my God, I thought you were going to kill me. And I'm really sorry that happened. When you were sharing, he was saying he thought that you were his dad. I'm like, I have no idea what he's talking. I don't know that girl. I don't know. And he's like, well, here's his cell phone number if you want to talk to him. I go, I think he wants to kill me out there, you know. Oh, no, he's just really upset. And like, okay. He goes, can I get your cell phone number? And I said, sure. And now the secretary of the meeting and the leader of the meeting were standing right there, and they're both like drop-jawed, you know. And they said, what's going on? I go, I don't know. And so, but I will tell you that I did know. I would like to tell you I didn't know. But, you know, when I was new, this happened 28 years ago. I had 2 years sober. And my escape was sex. There was no drugs, no rock and roll anymore. Couldn't punk rock it. It was like, and I weighed about 150, and I was still pretty good looking, you know, and so it helps. And, oh, is that a phone call? Oh, hi, Mom. No, I'm not high. I just need $40. And so, I love it when a phone rings. But so, I was very, I screwed everything that walked. I did. Man or woman, it didn't even matter. I mean, I'll go, in a dry spell, you just don't know. You know what I mean? And I do, and I tell you what, as he said that name, it didn't ring a bell to me, and but there was that one girl, you know, and I see what happened was I had compartmentalized that lie that I told myself that it had solved itself on its own, and put it in a box and shoved it away and forgot about it, and. Because I remember she came up and said, I'm pregnant. She was from France. I hardly understood her. We spoke a different language. And she was an au pair at this place. And I lived above the apartment, above the garage. And she was in the... Anyway, and we... You know how that works. And I saw her for about 3 weeks, and the owner of the house said, you've got to stop this affair. And I'm like, it's not me, man. Who can resist such a, you know, like, whatever. And they fired her. And I didn't see her for about 6 weeks. And she came, knocked on the door, and said, I'm pregnant. And I said I'd pay for the abortion. And that little conversation took about 15 minutes because she didn't speak very good English, and I am not French, so I hand her the money, and she's like, no, and I'm like, I'm not even sure it's mine. All the crap we say, you know, when that comes up, gentlemen, and I'm guilty of it, and she said she couldn't, she's Catholic, and I was like, you're on your own, and shut the door, and just put it in that box as it solved itself, and here it is, 28 years later, at an AA meeting, for God's sakes, in Newport Beach. Like, what are the odds? You know? And I had to drive back with Tim, and I was in a lot of denial, and then I said, okay, there was this one girl. You know, he's like, oh, there always is. And, what am I going to do, man? What am I going to do? This happened a month ago, right? He goes, here's what you're going to do. You're not going to do anything for 3 days. You're going to set on it. This was a Thursday night meeting. And so I had a five-hour drive back with him. It was like really godsend for me because I got to talk to Tim a lot. And so Sunday came. Oh, Saturday night, this kid called me. And his name's Cameron. And he said, my sponsor told me to call you and apologize. I'm like, dude, don't apologize if you're not feeling it.
That's the worst thing you can do. He's like, no, I realize now you didn't know. I go, I didn't know. And he's like, well, my mom, her name is Alice. And I was like, oh, man, that was her name. And she put me in foster care after I was born, and she went back to France. I was in the foster care system for 8 years. It's like, oh, man. I'm so sorry. Well, she met some other guy, and they moved back and pulled me out of the foster care system, and I thought that he was my dad for a long time. And I play professional soccer for the U.S. team, and we had to go to Brazil for some tournament a few years back, and I needed my birth certificate as well as my passport, and of course they didn't have it, and I filed for it and got it, and guess whose name on it? Frickin' Patrick Hugh Guthrie. Me and introducing myself with my last name. My name's Patrick Smith tonight, all right? What do you want to do, Cameron? Because I don't know. I don't know. No, I don't either. And we've been texting back and forth. And Sunday, I knew I had to tell my wife. I will tell you this about AA. It's really hard to keep a secret. No, it is. It kills you inside. It's like, you know, it's like a Bunsen burner. You just fire it up, or one of those torches. You know, it just burns. And I just wanted to tell her so bad. And but Tim put me on the 72-hour hold, and I got out. And he said this. He goes, well, I think you should play it like a funny thing happened on Thursday. I'm like, dude, I ain't going to say that. Are you out of your mind? Well, I'm just thinking. And so I set her down, and my daughter was gone, thank God. And I just told her. You know you marry the right woman when they say things like this. Patrick, there's something in the universe that needs your attention right now. And I think you should give it to him. And I thought, wow, I love you. And she says, I love you too. And it happened before we were married. But if it had happened when we were married, you'd be dead right now. And he's 27, honey. He's 27. And and a couple days passed, and I wasn't sure. I knew I was going to have to tell my daughter about it, you know. I mean, it's just like, God, it feels like fifth step with my family or something, you know. And I tell my daughter, you know, when Daddy first got sober, he was, you know, messed around a lot, and, you know. And she rolled her eyes like, how much longer is this going to take? She wants to watch TV, you know. And I said, look, I was at the meeting. I've got a son. She's like, what? And I've got a brother? And I'm like, yeah? She's, if he has a kid, I'll be an aunt. I'm like, yeah. You'll be a grandpa. I'm like, oh, no way did you say that. And I told her that he was in foster care and what had happened. She's like, it's just like the Fosters. She watches some show called The Fosters. And I'm just like, yeah. She goes, all right. And she starts a TV again. Like, it's no big deal to her. And I'm making this big deal out of it, right? And I'm just like, all this guilt and shame are coming up over this event. And Tim and I are talking, and I called a couple of other people and talked to them. I have a friend that's a cop. I know, I actually have a cop friend. And he's, you need to get a DNA test to make sure. I'm like, dude, that kid was mine. I can tell you, looked just like me. Well, I still think you should get a DNA test. And Tim was like, what if you did get the DNA test and it came back negative? Then what? I go, well, I'd be off the hook. He goes, no, you won't, because you're still feeling guilt and shame. And you wouldn't be free of it, because it's already there. It was already there. And that's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. I can forgive my dad. I can forgive God. I can even forgive Principal Farwell, that son of a gun, you know? And but when am I going to be able to forgive myself? When am I going to let myself off the hook? And I don't have the answer to that. I don't. And I'm telling you that this is a... And I'm really glad Mike read that little part after the chapter 5 that you weren't supposed to read. But that thing about... We claim spiritual progress, not perfection. Because that is what I cling to in this program. Just give me a little progress. Sometimes it is so slow. And other times I get huge leaps of progress. And right now I'm in the middle of it. And that's what it is, you know. It's life. I lost my mom in 2008. That seemed like a pretty traumatic thing for me. I think about her a lot, and I miss her. And my wife's mother turned 80 last Friday, and I had been working on a big birthday party for her. And we invited all of her friends, and this woman is like Miss Volunteer USA, and she's in the Daughters of the American Revolution, and she goes to this big church, and she's in the Seroptimus group, and she volunteers at driving people to a hospital and back, and I mean, she's epic. She is. She's epic. And so there were a lot of people there. And I put together a video. I cooked all the tri-tip. I went to a lot of trouble. Willingly, gladly, and after everybody had left that night, that Friday night, and she came in. She's not like a huggy feely person, you know, but she came in and she just said, "I really want to thank you," you know, and gave me a hug, and she goes, "You know, I know you're my son-in-law, and but why did you do this for me?" I'm like, "Nancy, because I love you." She goes, "I get that. I understand you do. But why?" And I go, "Because I couldn't do it for my mom. I couldn't do it for my mom. And I wanted to do this for her and you." She's like, "Well, she had one hell of a time, let me tell you. It was a great party." And that's what AA has taught me here. Just to stay steady. And sometimes you just hold on. And other times it's like flying high, and I'm very grateful. Thanks. All righty, give Patrick another round of applause, please. We had a lot of newcomers tonight. I didn't catch everyone's names, but just want to say thank you for being here. Seventh tradition, there are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. Seventh tradition at this meeting is used to cover speaker and meeting expenses, including one speaker a year. In September, from out of state, this year from North Dakota. Any leftover is given to central office, H&I, as well as district and area AA. If you have a court card, please have the person to your left or right sign it. Cards placed in the basket may not make it back to you. Alrighty, and announcements. Alrighty. So I want to first thank the people who are of service at this meeting. The potluck is Donna. Treasurer is Jeremiah H. Coffee, Drew and Randy. Greeting and raffle is Jessica and Mike. Literature is Jose, I believe. No? That's a different meeting. Alrighty. Taping is Kevin G. Canned goods, Cat.
Sound, Mike and Jose. Traction, Jeanette, C, and Sarah. Meeting coordination and setup is Lee Carroll. Alrighty. I'm going to give a round of applause for them. Alright. And announcements, meeting recorded. That was recorded by Kevin, and it will be available free on Central Office website. Tuesday and Thursday evenings, there are meetings here in this room. The STEP study, book study Tuesday, and Men's Stag Thursday. Both begin at 6:30 p.m. Coffee is on at 6. We also have Drop the Rock. A study of Steps 6 and 7 will begin on Wednesdays, May 25th at 6 p.m. in Old Orchid. I believe that's at your house, right? Alrighty, that's at Lee's house. The books are available at Central Office, or see Jeremiah or Paula for further information. And next week we'll be back in the church hall. Does that mean the other one? Okay. Potluck will be at 5:30. Donna has decided barbecue for the theme. Yeah. Nice. Alrighty. And if you'd help and be part of this meeting, if you want to be part of this meeting, see Jeremiah or Lee after the meeting. And no cleanup really necessary, right? Are there any other announcements from the floor? Do we do announcements from the floor? Yeah, go ahead. Kristen, alcoholic. Kristen.